Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kiley.
I'm Joshy.
And this is Engaging Culture, a podcast presented by Bridgeway Christian Church. On today's episode, we will talk about the one thing that the U.S. Surgeon General says is a powerful source of joy. We will talk about the reality of death and why acknowledging our mortality can help us live more fully today. And we'll look at some of the worst ideas of the 21st century so far, how we can be discerning when it comes to adopting new things that are seemingly always coming our way. We'll have some fun along the way. All of that and more on this episode of Engaging Culture. Well, Josh, it is your second week on the podcast, and we've already scared away Judah. So, congratulations.
Well, thank you. That has been my goal the entire time.
And I had confidence you could do it, but that you've done it so quickly is really pretty staggering to me.
The not showering really helps.
It really does. I'm glad I'm sitting across the table from you instead of next to you. Yeah. But, we'll see what we can. Pastor Judah is off this week. He'll be back with us next week. But, Pastor Josh, what is the best thing you saw this week?
There's some recent research that is suggesting that coffee drinkers are less likely to develop head and neck cancers. And if you know me, that means I'm in the clear.
Why is this relevant to you, Josh? I don't know.
I am obsessed and drink coffee at all times pretty much throughout my entire day. So I am cancer-free, and this is my cure. And this magical elixir, God's gift to me, is really pulling through right now.
And I just want to know, of all the things that a person could research, that there are researchers, smart, intelligent people out there going, we are going to study the relationship between coffee and not cancer in general, not hypertension, not any number of issues, specifically head and neck cancer. I'm not judging here. I just want to know, like, what leads a person to go, this is where I'm going to give my life?
Starbucks pays for this research is my guess. When it's brought to you by Folgers.
That ought to tell you something. So, okay. Well, my best thing, I'm simple, Josh. You and I are fans of the Sacramento Kings, and the winning streak may be over before this episode comes out, but at this very moment on Monday, January 13th, they're on a 7-game winning streak, and that's pretty fun. This team went from down in the dumps to cloud 9. You want to talk about whiplash?
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah, that's been pretty amazing. But fun to see him win. My boys are having fun with that. So am I. And
and to have Doug Christie, historical king at helm, is really makes it even more exciting for a lot of longtime, lifetime Kings fans.
Oh, yeah. I think that a lot of us were and are rooting for him, but we're really wondering, does he have the chops to get it done? And it's still early. It's only been 8 games. But so far, so good. Ride the highs while you got them. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. Vivek Murthy, our Surgeon General, is getting ready to leave his position and has released a parting prescription. In this parting prescription, he spends some time identifying one thing that is a powerful source of joy. Pastor Brian, what is the problem that Vivek is trying to solve?
The problem he is trying to solve is a huge one and an increasing one in America and all over the world. And the problem is loneliness. And it's pretty fascinating to me that here we have the Surgeon General of the United States saying, this is an issue we need to pay attention to. Yeah. He could have talked about obesity. He could have talked about alcohol use. He could have talked about tobacco use. Any number of issues, which obviously are unhealthy and cause a lot of problems. But he talks about a 2023 report in which he says loneliness leads to an increased risk of heart disease, dementia, depression, and anxiety. And he said in his parting prescription, quote, healthy relationships where we feel seen and where we can be ourselves can be a powerful source of joy and support and can be buffers to stress, which something that's interesting about that to me, Josh, is last week you were talking about on the show how when you are more connected in community, like unfair criticism doesn't quite get you as badly as maybe it would be if you're not.
Right.
And I hear, look at these comments where he says that healthy relationships can be a buffer to stress, like, that's a pretty powerful idea.
Oh, absolutely. And when you think about the relationships that you have, whether that's spouse or friends or whoever, where we find ourselves when stress comes is needing the comfort of others around us.
Yeah.
And needing a place where you can just unwind and be yourself. And I think what he says here as far as where we can be ourselves is a really important piece, because it's not in fake relationships.
Right.
And, you know, we'll go through a little bit more of where he finds this, but it's real authentic relationships where we get to be who we are, flaws and all.
Yeah.
That really helps us settle in, and the stresses of life don't affect us nearly the same.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely right. And he cites an important study that just came out this summer saying that 40% of us say they're not as close with their friends as they would like. And I think about the this is a meme that maybe some of you have seen that says Jesus's greatest miracle was having 12 friends in his 30s, which yes. I very much resonate with. But Josh, there are a lot of factors that lead to kind of the decline in friendship in America.
Yeah.
And Murthy highlights three of them. Three factors, he says, that have contributed to our loneliness epidemic. What's the first one?
Americans move more. So participation in many of the civic organizations that used to bring us together, like recreational leagues, service organizations, neighborhood associations, faith institutions, have declined, Murthy wrote. This idea that Americans are not settled in one space like we used to be. It used to be very common that you grew up in a community, you go away to college, you come back, you settle back into that community, and that's just where you are.
Yeah.
You go to First Baptist because that's the Baptist church closest to you. You know, you go to these, like that was an American standard for decades. And then now the mobility of Americans is so high. And I think we're also going to see this increase even more with remote work becoming a standard in a lot of industries.
Yeah.
Where you can live anywhere. And so people are taking pay of the bay and moving to Texas.
Yeah.
Because it's way cheaper.
Yeah.
And that mobility is great in a lot of ways, but presents a lot of loneliness problems.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think the issue is maybe less, okay, you make Bay Area money and you live in Texas. Hey, if you can get that deal, good for you.
Right.
The challenge is maybe you live in Austin, then you move to Dallas, then you move to, let's try a different state, we move to Tulsa. And the challenge is we're just not rooted anywhere. And I do think that there are lots of good reasons to move and lots of good reasons to leave a community. And I don't mean to moralize staying versus going necessarily.
Yeah.
But I do think that whether it is switching jobs, whether it's switching the place that we live, I do think we have a little bit of a kind of grass is greener approach where we undervalue the time we've spent cultivating relationships in our current place and also underestimate how much the loss of that is really going to impact us.
Absolutely. One of the things that I'm anecdotally noticing, so this is not research, but is a lot of people move for what this gets me. This is my property.
Yeah.
Very few people move for community.
Yeah.
Hey, we're moving to this area because we have a better community and better connection.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, because of my job, I interact with a lot of people who are at Bridgeway but have to move for different reasons, and they're still attending Bridgeway online because they haven't found community where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's we've moved, but our community is still behind us, and we haven't really attached to anything local. And I wonder if that's perpetuating the loneliness cycle, because we're not moving for community, we're moving away from community.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's a healthy thing to do. I also don't know that that's completely avoidable.
Yeah, totally. And there are certainly circumstances where yeah, you have to move for various practical reasons. But it is funny you bring that up. I'm getting ready this coming weekend. I'm going to get together with my four best friends from college. We get together once a year, and they all live relatively close to each other. One is in North County, San Diego. The other three are in the greater Los Angeles area, and then I'm up here. And that has actually been a topic we've discussed before, never like seriously in the sense that like we're all going to move and live together in the same area. But we've talked about that very same thing. Like, isn't it weird that we'll move to different places for jobs, but not for community and relationships? So I don't know. It's an interesting kind of conundrum of I don't know, the world.
Yeah, it's what's actually interesting about that, the way that you said that, is that that's actually why Johanna and I moved back to this area, was for family, community, and people that we knew beforehand. When we're in the midst of transition, instead of moving for a job, we said we wanted to pick an area and then find something and make it work in that area.
Yeah.
As difficult as that was. And so we did move here on faith without having a job, which is always a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
But that actually has turned out to be the best decision that we made for ourselves and for our kids, was actually highlighting family and community over job.
Yeah. No, similar. That's why we moved back 12, 13 years ago as well, was for exactly those same reasons. And yeah, same with us. It's worked out great. Now, so number one, Americans tend to move more. Number two, what's the second one?
Parents socialize with friends less. Because they are spending more time both at work and with childcare compared to a few decades ago, they don't have as much time to connect with peers, he wrote. How does that strike you?
I mean, I think it's absolutely true. I'm a bit of an oddity in that I love being around people and will gladly socialize. I hate being the one to organize it. And it's not that I'm not willing to do the work. I've like tried to psychoanalyze myself and I can't right. quite get around. Why is it the idea of like even texting my community group? Like, hey guys, let's try to get together this Sunday. I'm like, it just is like the weight of the world. Or to text a few friends, hey, let's all go do a thing. Like, right. I just hate that. And I don't know why. And I wonder if part of the challenge is we feel this kind of default sense of busyness, quote unquote, or hurriedness, and we just sort of assume other people are in that same boat, and we just kind of figure we don't have time for each other, which makes me think of another thing I heard a pastor I listened to say, where he said that the greatest challenge in spiritual formation is time, that yeah. too many of us just don't have time to be healthy. Right. And I don't know, that's what comes to mind for me, but I definitely feel that tension in my own life. How about you? What do you think?
Yeah, what's interesting to me is that you and my wife are very similar in that regard. Yeah. I just pester people. And so if like my good buddy John Miano will have 800 invites to every request accepted. And really what it is just is
wearing
that,
them down.
Just wearing them like down. It, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Taking the Steve Urkel approach. But I think what it means for me is that I have found that more people want to be invited.
Yeah.
Very few people want to invite.
Stop attacking me, Josh.
And because you're a bad person. No. And I want to be somebody who invites.
Yeah. No, I
and
love
that's
it.
And realizing that people are busy, so their no is not a rejection of me. It's yeah. a reality of time.
Yeah.
And I think for my wife, she doesn't want to inconvenience people. And there's the, well, if they don't want to hang out with me, now I got my hopes up and now I feel like
yeah.
they don't really want to be around. And
yeah.
it's like, and I totally get that. And that's a very normal response.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a really good thing for us to remember is that I think a lot of us are waiting for our phone to ring and yeah. invite us to go do something fun or just hang out.
Yeah.
But we're all waiting. And yep. if we're all waiting, nobody's inviting.
We're a bunch of awkward middle schoolers at the dance. We all want to dance, but someone's got to ask. So I don't know. That's a little bit of a dated reference. But anyway, so what's the third one?
Social media doesn't foster deep conversations.
What? What is this?
Groundbreaking.
Vivek Murphy, I know. What do you know?
Everybody take a moment. Friends have been replaced with followers and confidants with contacts with profound consequences for the depth and quality of our relationships.
Yeah.
So that sounds like you disagree. at this point.
No, I'm kidding, obviously. Yeah. I mean, and this has been something I've noticed for a long time, and that is that I struggle with a good analogy for this, but it's almost like social media gives us just enough a connection with others to kind of make us feel connected, but it's not enough for us to really be healthy. Like, I can be generally aware of the highlights or details, depending on the frequency of posting, of right. someone else's life and feel a sense of connection, but I'm not actually connected. But the challenge of that is that sort of pseudo connection causes me to not pursue the real thing.
Yeah. I heard an analogy on a radio show where they said that social media is like candy.
Yeah.
You can eat it, and eventually, if you eat enough of it, you can start to feel a bit full or sick to your stomach. But there's nothing nutritionally happening.
Yeah.
And I actually think that's a pretty apt description of what's happening with social media is when we treat social media as our community, we're in a lot of trouble. And it's not because I think social media in itself is inherently bad or that you shouldn't share these things. I think it's great to share these things. But when that's the only avenue, we start to get into really troubling pieces. So research with especially young girls off of Instagram, if they don't get enough likes or enough comments that are positive, they start to think negatively about themselves. They get online bullying starts to happen, or they're chasing this attention that they're not getting from an online medium, and that becomes their measure of self-worth. And that's why we don't allow our daughter to have social media, for one.
Yeah,
but
smart.
But the other side of that is, I think as adults who do have social media, like, we need to be really mindful of what this platform actually is.
Yeah.
And so I treat the platform as a ridiculous space. It is really just to make jokes and a mockery of all things. I rarely share anything personal on social media anymore. I used to, and now I just don't. I will text my family and friends pictures of my kids and things. I don't need to post it there. And so, but because I treat it differently, because this is true.
Yeah.
Like, I was getting too much of my connection through there, and there was no real depth.
Yeah. And I think that his prescription, if you will, is he talks about the need for technology-free zones in our lives where we can focus our attention when we're with others, and that this will enhance the quality of our interactions. And it's interesting that he specifically prescribes things like attending events at your local library or your church. And I think as Christ followers, this just speaks to just the importance of community, which of course we see all throughout Scripture. And I find that very motivating, especially when, even though I work here and even though I attend a ton of events here, as you do as well, that there can be that kind of inertia where you just kind of go, well, I'm home. And to get up and go to an event feels like a lot, or it feels vulnerable, or it feels this or that. But to realize it's actually worth the effort, because it's kind of like getting up off the couch to go for a walk or to exercise.
Right.
Like, over the long term, it's going to make a huge difference. And I think that treating loneliness as, first of all, a real problem.
Yeah.
Second of all, something that we're not the only ones who we experience. And then third, to go, we actually have some agency here to try to make a difference in this area. I think that can really motivate us to go, okay, yeah, I am going to go to the event. I am going to sign up for the community group. I am going to get involved in a serve team. Understanding that so much of the purpose of that is friendship and connection.
100%. Yeah. And I think the idea that we can treat loneliness like it's a problem that has solutions versus something that's just happening to us.
Yeah.
We don't have to be victims of loneliness. We have avenues to engage with others.
Totally.
And sometimes we have personal challenges that make that really, really difficult.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't take that lightly.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's difficult for us to develop those close relationships. But urging you to do whatever you can to develop one close relationship.
Yeah.
You don't need 800 friends, you need one friend.
Yeah.
Like
having a couple, 1, 2, 3 that are just like, those are your people.
Yeah.
And research shows this. It just makes a huge difference.
Absolutely.
Yep. We'll be right back. All right, enough talk about joy. Josh, let's talk about death, shall we? There was a terrific article by the always worth reading Arthur Brooks in The Atlantic recently, and the headline read, "You're going to die. That's a good thing." And I found it interesting that in the article, he cited a very famous book by American anthropologist Ernest Becker, The Denial of Death, which was written in 1973 that I had to read in seminary in 2000-something. And in The Denial of Death, Josh, he argues that we fill our lives with pastimes and distractions to avoid dealing with the reality of death. And he says we go to such lengths to avoid kind of facing that death is imminent that it affects all of us and really actually hijacks our lives in a lot of different ways. Now, Brooks argues that if we could kind of resolve this dissonance we feel about death and accept its reality, he asked the question, wouldn't life be better? And his answer to that question is actually yes. And he says that we know this because of the example of people who have accepted death and in doing so have become fully alive. And the article, which we'll link to, kind of gives some tips on how we can have the knowledge and the practice and the courage to be more fully alive as we face the reality of death. Now, I want to start with, why do you think we as Americans and even as Christians are so averse to kind of dealing with this reality of death?
I think it goes back into the original creation. We were not designed for death. Yeah. Death is a result of actions of ours. And so it was the first creation, we weren't supposed to die. Yeah. Like that wasn't a part of that. And so because that is now part of our reality, I think it's the recognition that that's wrong.
Yeah.
That's a deeper spiritual sense that we know death is wrong. We know that this doesn't feel right. This shouldn't be. And so we have to deal with that. So I think that's a big part of that. The other side of that, I think, is the unknown.
Yeah.
We have hope and faith in the next life, but none of us really know what that's going to be. And that unknown can be really scary. And if you don't come from a Christian background and of a faith, or you don't believe in the next afterlife pieces, you know, whatever that terminology is for you,
sure,
you're talking about no longer existing.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty heavy concept. And so because you have these combating ideas rolling through our heads, even as Christians, we still have the world's voice in our ears.
Sure.
It's a really heavy topic to, like, how do I contemplate my own mortality?
Yeah.
It's like, wow, this is really heavy.
Yeah. And I think you're right that there is an element of unknown. I think there's also a fear of dying. It's one thing to say, I feel this kind of way about death, but the process of dying is scary.
Yes.
Is generally very unpleasant, and that can be kind of fearsome. And I think that is a big reason why we kind of live our lives and don't want to think about it. But I think about scripture in Psalm 90, one of the few psalms that Moses wrote. And he says in verse 12, teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. Mm. Now, I am firmly in middle age, as are you, sorry to tell you.
What?
And on the one hand, I understand, like, something could happen and I could die at any moment, right? But I think functionally, I don't think about death that often. I think about living for many, many, many more years.
Yeah.
And yet, that verse has been so powerful to me to go, no, you got to understand your time on earth is limited, and your time on earth is not everything. We have eternity to look forward to,
right?
But time on earth is something to steward. And I think that there is a Christian perspective when we can acknowledge the reality of death, to acknowledge also, I think, the point you brought up that it is in one sense natural, but is also unnatural. Like,
right,
we were not made for death. Acknowledge that reality. And allow that to motivate us, not in a paranoid sense, but in a sense of going, this life is actually a gift and I don't want to waste it. And then we can have kind of the wisdom to steward our time in a way that just recognizes it's a limited resource.
Yeah, it's the same way that I think about my kids in the summers. So my daughter is turning 12, which means we have 6 more summers.
Yeah.
Before she's 18 and starts her life to go on to do her own things.
Yeah.
That's a really depressing number. It's only
pretty crazy
6.
When you put it in those terms.
Yeah, it's only 6 opportunities for us to leverage our summers in a way that can be a blessing and formational. And, you know, eventually she's going to leave our home, you know, hopefully. not because we don't love her, but like so that she could be successful in life, you know,
sure.
blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But just that reality is like, okay, if I don't think about the fact that we only have 6 opportunities, I could squander them.
Yeah.
Where if I say, hey, I only have 6 opportunities, I can create 6 moments with my child.
Yeah.
To be like, these are 6 investment moments. And yes, these will cost us more financially. Yes, it might not be like Dave Ramsey approved expenditures from time to time. You know, we're not going to go into debt over these things, but like, okay.
You want to make the most of it.
But you want to make the most of it and say, what's more important?
Yeah.
I have 6 opportunities to invest in my child that will affect the rest of her life.
Yeah.
These are memories and development pieces that will affect. And it's the same thing with them when we start to talk about death and our limitation. It's like, okay, I have 30 to 40 years statistically left.
Yeah.
What do I want to do in that time frame? I've got at least 25 years of work, probably more depending on how stock markets go. but I've got 25 years. What do I want to do in that 25 years of work? How do I want to spend my time? Is it going to be watching TV and making sure I'm up to date with all of the pop culture references?
Yeah.
Or is it going to be investing in others?
Yeah. I think about that all the time too, where I go, okay, what do I want to be able to say in 20 years? Man, I can quote any line from Brooklyn Nine-Nine or...
cool, 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 cool,
cool, cool, cool, cool, cool, cool, cool,
no doubt, no doubt,
no doubt. Or... do I want to be able to say, I have a great relationship with my sons. I have a healthy marriage. I've learned a new skill. I've served others. And, you know, I think about the old Mumford and Sons lyrics, in this body you will live, in this body you will die, where you invest your love, you invest your life. I think about, like, it sounds cheesy, but I think about that all the time.
Absolutely.
Especially, you know, ADHD, whatever. I end up giving my attention to stupid stuff all the time.
Yeah.
And I find that as something that kind of brings me back to go, actually, your life is a collection of the way you spend your time.
Yeah.
And time is a limited resource. And again, not from like a paranoid state or like a God is going to be mad at me state, but just a way of going like, what do I want to be able to say about the way that I spent my time years down the road? And if we can keep that thought in front of us, whether we're facing death imminently or not, I think that can steer us away from regret and steer us toward health in some ways. What do you think?
Absolutely. I think the idea of legacy is something that we don't talk enough about, especially in, you know, American Western culture, American Christianity, where our legacy really is something that we build now. There's that line out of Hamilton, I'm going to mess it up, but legacy is planting the seeds for a garden you never get to see.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, that's actually a really great way of saying, like, this is investment.
Yeah.
That we can invest our life or we can squander our life.
Yeah.
And I think that's really what this is coming down to, is how are we investing ourselves?
Yeah.
You know, I'm a big Mumford and Sons fanatic on a lot of things. And lyrically, like, that is one of my favorite lines that they've ever written.
Yeah.
And because it's just so profound, like, where you invest your love, that's where you invest your life.
That's it.
And like,
that's your life.
If that's going to sports games, that's great. Who are you bringing with you?
Totally. Yeah. No, absolutely.
Like, you can still enjoy these things. Like, How many shows are you watching at home by yourself in the dark because everybody else went to bed?
Right.
Versus how many things are you doing and talking about with the community around you?
Yeah, with people that with can bring people together. Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Now, on the topic of death specifically, obviously we all have all sorts of different feelings about it. And it's one of those topics that is so personal and so intimate and so emotionally loaded in a lot of ways that I don't want to sit here and prescribe to somebody how they ought to feel about it.
Right.
There's a tension I wrestle with. And I remember many years ago, my dad was a physician, and he was telling me about a physician friend of his, who I knew him pretty well also, who this friend of my dad's was a practicing Roman Catholic. So he was a person with a, you know, faith in God and all of that. And I remember him telling me that some of the most challenging patients to deal with in the face of death and challenging families were actually Christians. Who wow. They were the ones who would hold on for the longest, praying for a miracle or this and that, and would be least likely to accept, like, hey, your loved one is gone, or they're brain dead, or whatever.
Wow.
And I just thought, man, that really affected me. And I wrestle with, like, what is that line between, yes, we are called to pray for the miraculous, and and God can do the miraculous. But then also there's this sense of going, okay, death is not the end, that we have a hope. And little side note, I actually ended up, this is back when I was blogging like decades ago, and it got a lot of like interest on my blog. So I submitted it to Relevant Magazine, and it's the one time I've been published in Relevant Magazine. They chose wow. the headline, "Why Are Christians So Bad at Dying?" which I didn't love. What I did love is some smart aleck who commented, "I don't know. I died once. I'm totally rocked." which I think, which is sort of helps with the point of like, we can have all these ideas, but none of us really know. But I think there's that question of going, truly, how do we balance that? And I don't have a good answer, but I think that, I don't think the right answer is to not think about it and to not at least have some thought of how are we going to approach that, you know, if and when we have to face that with ourselves, with a loved one, or somebody else.
Yeah. I wonder if in times where life was shorter, you know, our lifespans are so much longer now.
Yeah.
You know, we're into the 80s a lot of times, and 80s, 90s is not unheard of to get past 100 anymore. Like that's not making the news every day like it used to.
Yeah.
The Today Show used to say, "Here's all the people that just passed 100."
And that would be the whole episode.
But the but when time was shorter, I think there was a more intentional reality. Like, hey, we only have so many things that we're going to die from something. So the idea of dying well, dying with honor, was a big thing.
Yeah.
Because they lived to 35, 40 years old.
Like,
they weren't dying with honor in their 70s. It was, they're our age.
Yeah.
And like, okay, we know we're going to die from something. And that reality of death, I think, was actually probably pretty healthy in a way of like, what are we willing to die for?
Yeah.
And I think that's a really good question for us as Christians. Like, what are we willing to die for?
Yeah.
It's not necessarily what are we willing to die from, but what are we willing to die for?
Yeah.
Like, are we willing to die to ourselves? Are we willing to die for the cause of Christ? Are we willing to, like, we say that. We say, oh, I'm willing to die for the cause of Christ, but then we won't, you know, contemplate our own mortality.
Yeah.
It's like, that's a really odd juxtaposition.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, just what are your thoughts on?
Yeah, I think that there's an understanding, certainly of the miraculous, and we want to be cognizant of that. But also, I think that there is a power in suffering well and suffering with hope. And whether we're talking about death, which is kind of the ultimate in earthly suffering, or suffering in some other ways, that oftentimes God can be glorified, not sometimes he's glorified in the relief of our suffering, but sometimes he is glorified in the manner in which we can fix our hope on him in the midst of our suffering. And the last thing, again, I want to do is be heavy-handed with somebody, or I think, you know, we get into these emotionally fraught situations and our best laid plans often go out the window. But I think just to have a theology that can account for everything from miraculous healing to faithful suffering. And like, this sounds cynical and negative, but like understanding like Lazarus is dead. Like Jesus raised him and then he died later. You know what I'm saying? Like
right.
Just this sense of, yeah, like we're going to die. Our earth is not our home.
Yeah.
And we can have a joy in something else, even in the midst of grief. I think it's just important to keep that perspective.
Absolutely. Death is not the end.
Yeah. 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 And praise God for that.
Amen.
We'll be right back. So we are going to end this episode, as we always do, with a game. But Josh, this segment we're going to do right now feels like a bit of a segue into that, in that we are going to look at an article from BBC Science Focus where it described the worst ideas of the 21st century so far, one of which was...
The segue.
But we're not going to talk about that. And the purpose in this is partially to have fun riffing on things we thought were going to be great, but were actually terrible. But also, just I think it's an open door to just talk a little bit about kind of wisdom and discernment and calm and how do we kind of embrace, or not even embrace, but just sort of process new things in the world without either like total hysteria of like, oh my gosh, it's going to be amazing, or total hysteria of like, this is the end of the world and it's terrible.
Right.
So hit us with, we're each going to talk about two. Hit us with the first bad idea of the 21st century.
The metaverse. Mark Zuckerberg thought that the metaverse with the avatars for all of us and that we get to live in this complete virtual space was going to take over everything. It has not.
What?
I know. And so now people don't use the Quest for Metaverse. They use it to play video games.
Yeah.
It's a gaming console. What I actually find really interesting is that when the metaverse first started popping up in church communication circles, it was a big conversation of how do you leverage the metaverse? How are you setting up your online church congregants?
Yeah.
How are you doing all these different things? Like, this is going to be the future. And there's so much anxiety for some folks of like, well, we're not set up to do that. We don't have the technology to do that. And then there's so much, you know, stuff from people being like, well, this is dumb. Now, I was one of the ones who said, this is dumb. And the reason why I knew this was dumb was that there's nothing virtually that has been able to take place that has replaced human contact and relationship.
How about that?
I know. Isn't that weird? And so I looked at this, said, this is just another one of those.
Yeah.
And so Zuckerberg... Bad idea.
Swing and a miss. You may have had a few other swings and misses along the way as well.
What's one of yours?
NFT art, which NFT stands for non-fungible tokens, which really the word fungible should have been a key indicator this was going to be a bad idea. And I will admit, there was a whole kind of... company that made these basketball-related NFTs called Top Shot, and I briefly got into it a little bit, and I will admit, it was a little bit fun to buy packs and open them. It kind of reminded me of trading cards as a kid.
Yeah.
You can buy them and sell them, and they increase and decrease in value and all of that. But I remember, even as I was doing this, I'm going, they're little video clips.
Like, correct.
What am I purchasing here? And then you would see, you know, I would buy a pack for $10, right?
Yeah.
And you'd see some of these, like, some of these NFTs going for tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of dollars. And you're like, I just didn't, like, why?
Why?
What are we doing here?
Apparently they didn't have access to YouTube.
Yeah, exactly. So. Like, what is happening?
Yeah.
And I just think it is hilarious that now analysts in 2024 said that 96% of all NFT collections were effectively dead, worthless, meaningless, when literally you had people spending... there were some that maybe went into the millions of dollars. And I'm not talking about sports. So it's just like all over the map.
Right.
Millions of dollars.
For digital art.
Like,
I have a lot of black market NFTs. And I'm willing to sell them to you for a small
quarter?
Fee.
Yeah.
For a small fee.
It's just, I mean... That it lasted even as long as it did is remarkable to me. That is truly, even though I got it, like I said, the collecting, buying, selling was kind of fun, but it's why? What are we doing here? So NFT art, big swing and a miss there as well. All right, what's one more from you?
So this one's probably going to be a little bit more explanation needed, but it's the like button.
The like button.
The like button or the heart button on Instagram, whatever you want to do. This is actually, research has shown that this has actually been more detrimental to public health than almost anything else on social media because—
Isn't that crazy?
It has driven people's dopamine response to their posts. They post and they need X amount of likes before they can get that release in their brain. And so there's a chemical thing going on there. And now we have like, well, people don't love me. They don't like the pictures of my children. They don't like this. Like, how dare they be like, I guess nobody really cares anymore type of thing. All started with the like button. Before the like button, nobody knew whether they liked something or didn't like something.
You post things to actually share them with the world.
And then people like make a comment or two, but but that was it. It wasn't about your hierarchy and your social class type of a thing. It was very, so yeah, that's been very detrimental to society and it still exists. It's still a bad idea.
Yeah, it is still a bad idea. And you think about how much of social media now is less about sharing things with the world and how much is geared towards how am I going to get the most engagement, the most this, the most that. Yep. And it's all of us screaming for attention.
Correct.
I don't know. It's shocking that that's not good for our mental health. So the last one I will highlight is the beautiful and wonderful and aesthetically pleasing Google Glass, which were glasses made by Google that looked terrible.
They
were so ugly. And it's sort of like how, like, I don't know, back in like the late 90s to early 2000s, how a lot of us would wear little like Bluetooth things on our ears and we all sort of collectively as a society realized they look ridiculous.
Oh yeah.
That it took, I think, us as a society about 10 minutes to realize space age Star Trek glasses do not look as cool as Back to the Future 2 led us to believe.
Right. Yeah. I feel like Steven Spielberg lied to me.
And my jacket does not dry when I press a button. Come on.
No, not even a little bit.
But like, I mean, I don't know. I think about like just the idea that we wanted to be able to check our email from our glasses while taking a walk. It sort of heartens me in kind of our societal rejection of some of these things where we just go, okay, there is actually a limit to how much I want technology to intrude.
Yeah, and Facebook is doing the thing with the Meta glasses with Ray-Bans and all that. And those look a little bit different and they function differently.
At least there's a better design.
There's a better design, but I still think that's going to be a fad. Yeah. I'll be proven wrong later. Write your emails. I don't care.
We'll see.
Well,
here's what all this makes me think about. And I, Ephesians chapter 5, I almost brought this up in the last segment because it applies there as well. It's one of my favorite passages. Look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise, but as wise, making the best use of the time because the days are evil. And the point of the verse is not to say, oh my gosh, the world is this terrible place and you need to be afraid of it. But the point of the verse is to go, we need to be intentional about the way we live our lives. We need to be thoughtful about the decisions we're making because if we just kind of go with the flow all the time, we're going to end up in places we didn't intend to go. And I think that I'm not a fan of sort of this is the one thing that's going to solve all our problems.
Right.
I'm also not a fan of this complete arms folded skepticism of everything.
Yeah.
What we need as Christians is, as Pastor Lance would say, calm wisdom to discern the times and to be able to recognize the promise of new technology and new inventions and also the fact that like the limitations of those things, that actually whatever technology we have, whatever new ideas we have, we're still who we are, and we still have to kind of deal with that reality.
Absolutely. And we leverage the like button within our Instagram pieces for us as a church because it shows us what's connecting with people, what's not connecting with people, and then how are we a light in the darkness? How can we get more eyeballs not on us, not just because we want to have a large following number up there, yeah. but because we want to have influence in people's lives.
We're seeking to add value.
We're seeking to add value. And it's not, and so that like button does serve a purpose
sure.
in that respect. So even in the things that are like, man, this is not so great, there are ways of using what the world is meant for evil, God can use for good. there are ways of doing that.
Yes, that is true.
And I do think that it's always a good reminder that when we see things coming out, we don't hit the panic button immediately.
Yeah.
You know, the amount of outcry to the metaverse, like, this is going to ruin churches, this is going to ruin, like, blah, blah, blah. It's like, okay, let's see if this even has, if anybody actually wants this.
Yeah.
So far, nobody actually wants this. Like, this is, they're trying to create a solution to a problem that does not exist yet.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, I think it's so important for us to just be slow in our response.
Yeah.
Of like, hey, how is this really going to affect? And for those of us in ministry and leadership, it's also a good reminder of, is anybody asking for this thing that we're giving? It's like, hey, we have 8 million great ideas. Who's asking for this?
What problems are they solving? What needs are they meeting?
But yeah, what needs are they meeting? Like, the thing that always kills ministries is we should do this, we should do this, we should do this, that nobody's actually asking for.
Yeah.
And like, and so we get into this ministry mindset of like, yeah, we should offer all these different things. And then we try to, we do it poorly. It doesn't work because nobody really wants it.
Yeah.
And then we're scratching our head like, but we spent so much time.
Yeah. And I think there's wisdom in that in business, in family life, in all sorts of different areas to go, okay, are we actually serving a purpose, meeting a need, or are we just trying to kind of have the new hot thing? So we selected these four because they were kind of funny. Most of the rest of them are actually not that funny. They're pretty serious, but it's worth a read. We'll link to it in the show notes. Check it out. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. We are going to play a little game called Blessed or Stressed.
Yes, we are.
This is where we share an idea or something that's going on in society around us, and we say, does this bless us? Are we excited about this? Or does this stress us out? Do we hate this idea going forward? Brian, what is your blessed or stressed topic today?
So, Josh, and just to remind our listeners, you are hearing this for the first time from me, at least. You do not know what I'm about to say. This is from a British publication. It's from a couple of weeks ago. And the headline is so British. I love it. Mosh pit nappy designed to avoid queues at gig lose sells out. Here is the story, my friend. The good people at Liquid Death, a brand that sells sparkling water looking cans. It is pretty good stuff. They have begun selling the limited edition pit diaper specifically for mosh pits at music gigs. They made it available for an equivalent of $75 US. And the firm's promotional material said this: if you have been to a concert, you know the scariest place isn't the mosh pit, it's the bathroom, which I have not been to a concert where I would say that, first of all. And then it goes on to say, now you can avoid having to brave that hellscape with the new pit diaper, allowing fans to, quote, relieve themselves in the safety of the mosh pit. These adult diapers have they are covered in black pleather, and they often include metal studs and chains. So they're basically fancy, and
coming
I lose
to a
that
dungeon
term
near you
very
yes.
loosely. Diapers that adults are wearing so they don't have to leave the mosh pit to go to the bathroom. I ask you, my friend, are you blessed or stressed by this invention?
I am so blessed right now, mostly because if you purchase and wear these, the world deserves to know who you are and what your name is so we can avoid you at all costs. This is, you are wearing pull-ups, and you're just adding like accessories to them? Like, I don't
voluntarily, I might add. Like, some people, they have a medical condition, whatever. Like, okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Like, complete compassion for that. But it's the voluntary element.
It's the voluntary, and then trying to make it look cool. Yeah, no, no. I think if you're at a concert that you can't hold the bowels, you shouldn't be at that concert. that's...
Okay.
Yeah.
So you are blessed by it because it identifies people you want to avoid.
Correct.
But it sounds like you are stressed.
It's a terrible idea.
The cleanup afterwards, I don't know. I also am very stressed by that. I can understand the desire to, you don't want to miss the show, you don't want to miss, but like, good grief, go to the bathroom. There are better solutions. I share your stress at, gosh. I'm concerned about this. But I am also, I don't know that I'm blessed in the same way that you are. I'm definitely stressed in the same way that you are. How about you? What's yours?
Well, mine's not nearly as good as that. So, like, I feel very sad about mine because that was fantastic.
Well, hopefully less gross.
Well,
anyway,
yes.
Go on.
Drone deliveries are increasing and getting ready to launch from Amazon to drone deliver to your home.
Yeah.
Does that bless or stress you, having hundreds of these things flying around our neighborhoods?
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So we're replacing the little electric trucks that deliver our stuff with drones that are just going to
drop
that glass dishware
on your head.
Like Ace Ventura Pet Detective
crush
style
the cat
here.
As it goes through.
I gotta think about this. I am stressed by the aesthetic. I don't love the look of just drones flying around. I am stressed by the potential for any number of items to interfere with the flight of said drones, whether it is a kid playing football in the street or a kid or grown up shooting them with a BB gun.
Right.
I am stressed by the potential of dropping an item, damaging a person or living thing, or damaging the item. Item being of much less importance, of course. I'm stressed by the potential human job loss. I'm blessed by the convenience of it. The idea that it can make all of this a lot simpler, but I don't know. Overall, like, it's probably the direction we're going, and it'll probably be fine. But I think overall, I am as much as I'm pro driverless car, I'm a little stressed by non-human delivery. How about you?
I am stressed by this. Part of that could just be the fact that I am too old now to accept the modern technology.
Early adopter phase is over.
Is over. Yes, my arms are folded in a cynic in this moment. I just don't see how this works practically.
Okay.
You know, in a city where you have high rises and apartments, how do you deliver into a part? Is it zooming through the halls?
That's a great point.
Dropping it on the front porch would be stolen by anybody with the key? Like, how is this workable? Is one thing. The other thing is, I don't love the idea of our airspace being taken up by that buzzing sound.
Yeah.
For deliveries.
Yeah.
It's like, because that's the one thing Americans don't need is easier ways to buy things online. Like we...
A fair point.
We've got that.
We're really solid on that.
You know, I was at the grocery store the other day and I saw somebody trying to find a parking spot. It was a little crowded. There's plenty of parking in the back and I watched them not park, get frustrated and drive off. I just sat in my car and watched because it was so entertaining to me. And I was like, we don't even want to walk from the back parking spots to the grocery.
I cannot be bothered.
We've gone too far. Yeah. We need to readjust. It should be harder to buy things. It should require us to do stuff.
Yeah.
Our bank accounts would really appreciate leg work versus thumb work. Yeah. And so I think we'll be fine.
I was listening to a podcast the other day where it was a columnist who's got it was a pretty famous podcast. But he's talking about exactly that, how commercialism has invaded every space of our lives. I don't walk to a bookstore and buy a book. I sit in bed and order a book on my Kindle.
Right.
And drones are coming.
Yeah.
But
the drones are coming.
The drones are coming. We're a little stressed by it. But we are not stressed by the fact that you listened to this episode. Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, leave us a rating or review. We'll be back next week. Bye.